doubt the Polish electorate will see it the same way, Anna noted. Hence the reason you're here, right?
Precisely.
Of course, no one who matters will acknowledge the Warsaw Protocol ever existed, much less the good it did. The end result will be that I will be branded a traitor, a spy for the communists. I will take the fall for everyone. Father Hatje was not cooperative. Not at all. And you are well informed. I learned a long time ago to stay at least one step ahead of you, Janusz. Two, preferably. He'd once loved this woman, and a small part of him still did. She understood him like no one else, not even Sonia. He'd decided to come to Kraków on an impulse, with only the vaguest idea of what he expected to accomplish. He'd flown south from Warsaw in a cold sweat, chewing at his lip, all thoughts frozen in the past. He'd hoped that once here he might figure it all out. A futile hope, for sure, as he remained in a deep turmoil. But he imagined his wife found herself in a similar quandary.
This is the most serious threat we've ever faced. My political career could be over, he pointed.
Your career will be over.
She shrugged.
It seems we constantly face one challenge after another. Why should this be any different?
Because it is different. The Americans and Russians are involved. A lot is at stake.
Does she love you?
The question caught him off guard. Never had they discussed their mutual diversions.
She does.
That's good. You may not believe this, but I want you to be happy,
as I do for you. I have no desire to harm you in any way. She was still his friend, and always would be.
I was there, Janusz. I was born into that horrible communist society. I know its mindset. You don't have to convince me that times were tough. Survival depended on following the rules and avoiding attention. I remember it all quite clearly. And I agree. I shed no tears for those traitors. So I've come to help. But I have to know what we're facing. I need the truth.
So he told her everything that had happened over the past few days.
I understand, she said when he finished. We cannot allow foreigners to dictate how this country is governed. Never again.
She might be an estranged spouse, but she was first and foremost a Pole, and a proud one at that.
You and I do not see eye to eye on many things, she said, but on this issue, we're united. Why are you waiting here?
For Sonia to report in. The last thing I heard was gunfire.
Should you send people south to that castle?
He'd been considering just that, but he'd promised Sonia not to interfere and let her handle it.
I can't. Not at the moment.
She seemed to understand why and said, What would it hurt to get your men close, ready to move at a moment's notice?
Not a thing.
He stepped to the door and summoned Zhima back inside, telling him what he wanted to happen.
Stay back a few kilometers, but close enough to move quickly if needed. How fast can you have people there?
I have six already at the Slovakian border. I was hoping you'd give this order.
He smiled.
Take care of it.
Zhima left. Anna stood from the sofa.
I have a mission too.
He was curious.
Can I ask what?
It's time I pay a visit to Jasna Góra. Father Hatje and I need to have a talk.
You might find that a bit one-sided.
She shook her head.
Come now, Janusz. You know how persuasive I can be.
Chapter 53
Cotton stepped away from the arch, surrounded by carnage. Sonia had executed Jaunty Olivier in cold blood. What better way to protect both Poland and Tchaikovsky than by eliminating the source of the problem? Clearly, she hadn't known the location of the auction. The Russians had shared no intel with her. And why would they? The last thing they wanted was Olivier dead. So she'd set the trap with the spear and allowed him to spring it. That way, Olivier, the Russians, or whoever might be watching would not be spooked, and she'd get a clear shot. He was still concerned about Ivan and Eli Reinhardt.
They could be lying in wait. So he carefully made his way toward the front of the castle, finding a room from which he could gaze down at the courtyard. There he watched as Ivan, Reinhardt, and Munoz left in a black sedan. He then saw Sonia as she calmly walked across the cobblestones and out the main gate, with the boxed spear in her grasp. There was still the matter of Eli Reinhardt. Something wasn't right there. He wished he knew more about the man. Why was he involved? Why would he agree to take the risk of participating in the murder of government representatives, several of which were anything but friendly, and make a deal with the Russians? Olivier's comments only confirmed that he and Reinhardt had been somewhat working together, Olivier lamenting how foolish he'd been to trust the man. A double cross? Maybe. And when Sonia gunned Olivier down, Reinhardt had seemed far more relieved than shocked. Was this over? Was the information truly gone? Sonia apparently had been unconcerned with Reinhardt, leaving without giving him another thought, satisfied the situation had been contained. Had she made a mistake? The castle loomed cemetery quiet. He left the front room and headed back to the great hall. Bullet holes scarred the walls and floor, while pools of blood framed out the casualties. He walked to Olivier's body, the face a waxen mask, the eyes closed but distended. He searched the pockets, finding nothing except a small chunk of yellow-white rock crystal. Odd that Olivier would be carrying it. He wondered about its significance. He pocketed the chunk and recalled Olivier asking about an associate, a man named Vic, and decided the second floor would be a good place to look. So he found the stairs and climbed, passing the two dead Russians, then searching rooms until he located a bedchamber that had been converted into a command post. Another body lay on the floor with bullet holes. He was about to search that corpse when he noticed the right-hand pants pocket, turned inside out, as if somebody had already been looking. He searched anyway and found only a wallet, a set of car keys, and a cell phone. A British driver's license identified Victor DeGenti. Vic. The video monitors were still working, displaying images of the outer walls and the forest beyond, especially the road near the main gate. All quiet. One of the split-screen images was of a vehicle parked inside the walls, probably down one of the alleys he'd noticed when he'd exited the car that had brought him earlier. The one Olivier had mentioned, ready for his exit, harboring the Arma Christi. He noticed a laptop hot-wired from the wall, surely the means whereby the high bid would have been authenticated and a wire transfer verified. He assumed that Reinhardt had killed DeGenti first, giving his co-conspirators an open run to everyone else. All of the staff had apparently been ordered from the premises, leaving everything overly vulnerable. Foolishness on Olivier's part. But just add that to the list of improbable chances the man had taken. He wondered, had Reinhardt come here first and found something? Olivier had said that only he knew the location. During the auction, he'd also said DeGenti would lead the highest bidder to the information, which made sense. A man like Olivier did not seem the type to do the heavy lifting. No. He'd pay for that service. And what other person besides the one man Olivier had specifically inquired about with Reinhardt? Had this guy known the location? Of course, he was speculating, like the lawyer he used to be. But it all seemed reasonable. He opened DeGenti's cell phone, but it was password protected, so he tossed it back on the body and decided to search the remainder of the castle to find Olivier's room, which he did farther down the hall. It was elegantly furnished with a heavy wooden table, a four-poster bed, a carved chest, and a dark wood wardrobe filled with clothes that were clearly Olivier's size. It all smelled of polish, soap, and fresh flowers. The afternoon sun threw in a reddish glow, exposing patches of dust on the furniture. Save for some toiletries and a couple of novels, there was nothing else. He left there and the second floor, exploring the ground level, eventually finding what had once been the castle's library. No books lined the shelves. A large piano occupied one corner, a few choice lithographs adorned the walls, a rug lay underfoot. French doors opened to a stone terrace. He searched for anything that may have been compromised. Curiously, there was a vacuum seal machine,
the kind used to preserve food, sitting on a small table. Not much littered the top of the Victorian-style desk, except for three cell phones, all password-blocked. He wasn't going to learn anything fast from those, so he walked back to the Great Hall. How long would it be before the respective governments of the dead learned what had happened? Not long, a matter of hours. The response? That would be a challenge, considering the illegality of the entire venture. He approached the big screen television. Olivier lay nearby. He recalled the documents that had been displayed and glanced behind, noticing a laptop connected to the screen. He scrolled through the five images displayed on the left side, which Olivier had shown the assemblage. Nothing else was loaded on the machine. Then he noticed something. Resting beneath the machine on a wooden shelf was a large manila envelope, like the ones that had been used during the auction. He slipped it free and tested its weight. Heavy. He tore off the flap and opened it to find an oversized coffee table book. Miastov Soli, The City in Salt. He only knew that since there was both English and Polish on the cover. Inside was the same, the text in both languages, all of the glossy colored images of the underground salt mine at Vialichka. He thumbed through the pages and admired the extraordinary pictures. On the end page was writing, in blue ink, 9 Bobola. He thumbed back through the book to see if there was any more writing, but found none. On page 145, one of the full-page images caught his eye. Yellow-white crystals clung to a gaping fissure in the mineshaft wall. No caption identified the photo, but he found a legend at the end, the book's author stating, Lower Level 9, a fragment of roof of the upper grotto covered with large halite crystals. He found the piece in his pocket that Olivier had been carrying and compared it with the photo. Identical. He brought it to his lips and cautiously tested the outer surface with his tongue. Salty. The tantalizing fragments of a pattern formed in his brain, and the math was anything but fuzzy. This 2+2 had to equal 4. Chapter 54. Eli was glad to be away from the Russians. He and Munoz had ridden north with Ivan, back into Poland, with their mouths shut. His deal with them had worked out perfectly. They'd paid him 5 million euros to work his way into the auction, direct them to the location, then facilitate the elimination of the participants. The Russians wanted every delegate dead. They also wanted Olivier alive. But that had not worked out. The Poles had intervened. Malone had survived. Luckily, Ivan did not hold either of those unexpected occurrences against him. Ivan deposited them near the main square in Kraków, surely on his way to the nearby Russian consulate and home soil. He wondered how long it would take for the carnage at Storny Castle to be discovered. Surely the staff had returned by now. But perhaps the Poles had cleaned up the mess and disposed of the bodies. That would make more sense. The last thing they would want was public attention. The time was approaching 3 p.m., and he was hungry. But he also needed information. He knew that Jonty had visited the nearby Vialichka salt mine twice in the past 48 hours, once to find the pantry, but the other visit, the first one, had been all Olivier's call. Munoz had told him about the torture with the electrical wire down the throat and how he'd finally coughed up a name. Ordinarily, he'd be upset with such weakness. But here it told him that Jonty had returned to the mine after learning that a competitor was watching. Had he hedged his bets? Perhaps. And Vic DeGenti would have been right there with him. In his pocket, he found the paper that he'd lifted off the corpse. 9 Bobola. What did it mean? Was it relevant here? Or did it have nothing to do with any of this? He believed Olivier when he'd said that no documents were at the castle. That would have been a wise precaution, one he himself would have taken. Was it possible that Jonty had decided the salt mine was the perfect place to stash his prize? Why not? It certainly was isolated, and there were endless possibilities for secreting something away. He should at least investigate before dismissing the thought entirely.
Krakow was not unfamiliar to him. He'd visited many times, and one of his favorite places to eat was Pod Aniovami. It sat about halfway between the main square and Wawel Castle, on a busy pedestrian-only side street. It served traditional Polish cuisine, using the old recipes, all cooked on a charred beechwood grill. The ambiance was lovely, too, reminding him of places he'd visited in the countryside. Its decor the kind of knick-knacks you'd find in people's homes. He led Munoz to the restaurant. They took a table in the cellar, surrounded by rough stone walls and arches straight from the Middle Ages. Nobody else was enjoying a late lunch, so they had a measure of privacy in the dimly lit chamber.
"I want you to find a man who works at the Wieliczka salt mine," he whispered to Munoz. "He's a guide named David Konrad. I met him last evening. Go there. Ask around. Find him. I must speak with him immediately."
Munoz had worked for him before, and Eli knew him to be dependable. Of course, getting caught by Olivier had not been one of the Bulgarian's finest moments, but it all worked out in the end. He prided himself on being adaptable. Being here, right now, seemed proof positive of that. He'd managed to eliminate a competitor and secure an unobstructed path to information that could prove quite valuable. But he would not make the same mistake Jonty had made. If found, he'd sell directly to the Russians for a fair price, taking every euro earned as icing on the cake of the 5 million he'd already pocketed. Of course, the Poles might pay more. Either way, the information would be suppressed, and no missiles would be deployed. Right now, he wanted food. He and Munoz discussed a few more details. Then his acolyte rose and climbed the steep stone steps back to ground level. For the first time in the past few days, he relaxed. No one was left to interfere. All of the parties had either been killed or placated. He again found the paper with the writing on it. 9 Bobola. He needed to know if it was relevant, especially before speaking with Konrad. He still had control of the pantry, now his alone to sell. But what he wanted was the information on Janusz Czakowski. Olivier's fate had offered a glimpse at the disaster that came to those who tied themselves to limited capabilities. He wanted to be freer, more flexible. He felt a panicky need for some assurance that he could escape the path he'd just taken with his life. What he should do was walk away, leave it alone. He had more than enough. But that was not his nature. He was a broker, buying and selling every day, taking risks. And out there, right now, waiting to be found, was something of great value. And not only in money, but also to his reputation as a dealer. So go for it. He found his phone and typed Bobola into a search engine. What appeared both surprised and intrigued him. Cotton approached the light-colored BMW that he'd seen on the monitor upstairs in the room where Victor Genty had been killed. He'd retrieved the keys from the body, hoping they were for the vehicle, and was pleased when the fob opened the door locks. On the rear seat, he spotted various containers that held the relics of the Arma Christi. He'd noticed that there were 6. When he subtracted the one Sonia had taken, it made for 7. Where had the 7th come from? Earlier, one had been missing on the table in the Great Hall. Another mystery. No matter, though. He now had the relics, and he was certain that the churches from which they'd been taken would be grateful beyond measure for their return. It would be quite a feather in Stephanie's cap to be able to make restitution. He needed to call her, but had no way at the moment. He would have to wait until he was back in Poland. Right now, he just needed to get as far away from here as possible before the crap hit the fan. He was still playing a hunch, one he knew Stephanie would want him to pursue. And though he no longer had any dog in this fight, he was intent on finding out if the information on Czakowski was still out there, capable of being located. Was the threat still active? The silence around him was broken by the cawing of a crow. An omen? He hoped not.
He was alive thanks to Sonya's intervention, and what he was doing by keeping in pursuit might be deemed a problem by her. She'd wanted this to be over. But something told him there was still a way to go. Chapter 55. Tchaikovsky wanted this day to end. It had been one of the most nerve-wracking of his life, and he'd experienced some pretty harrowing ones. Speaking with Anna had brought back memories he preferred not to relive. It happened so fast on the night of December 12, 1981, when the Polish military swept in and imposed martial law. Most of Solidarity's leaders were rounded up and herded to freezing detention centers, cast on the mercy of brutal guards. Over 40,000 people. Neither he nor Mirek Hatchia was part of that roundup. Hatchia because he constantly stayed in the shadows, and himself as a nobody. It had all been horrible. But people had debated for years whether Poland, without martial law, would have made it through that winter. Widespread famine seemed imminent. The healthcare system was about to collapse. The economy was gone. Anarchy loomed, and neither the government nor Solidarity possessed the ability to develop workable solutions. With power came responsibility. Leaders had to get along, put petty differences aside, avoid division over trivial matters. But Solidarity had constant problems with unity. At least it wanted to compromise. But the red bourgeoisie, who would have had to relinquish many of their class privileges, refused to budge. No deals. By then, all that remained of the Polish Communist Party was the complacent, the incompetent, the corrupt, and the evil. Thankfully, the army stayed at bay. Polish soldiers refused to fire on Polish workers. But the militia, the SB, and the special forces were another matter. They did the dirty work. One person at a time. He recalled the sense of defeat that dominated throughout that winter. Poles seemed to know that Poles always lost. It had been that way for centuries. Doomed by geography and ideology, they had never effectively governed themselves. The whole idea of martial law had been to isolate and neutralize any obstructive groups and deprive the people of knowledge, save for what the government decreed. For years, Solidarity had existed out in the open, keeping the people informed. Now it was gone. Subverted. Made illegal. There was no more information network. Phone lines were cut. Television shut down. Everything required a permit. Even typewriters had to be registered. So implementing the Warsaw Protocol had been easy. Feeding the SB false information had been easy. Turning one against the other, setting up traitors even easier. Their deaths just the price to be paid. And the last holdouts? 2,000 coal miners in Silesia, barricaded underground in protest, cooped up in low, dark, climby shafts, thick with winter dampness. No ventilation, no light. Just days before Christmas. To get them out, the government engaged in its own form of the Warsaw Protocol by feeding down false stories of ill family or wives in labor. Women impersonated their loved ones, begging them to surrender. Anything to break their resolve. But the coal miners knew a lie when they heard one. They were tough. They'd always been regarded with high honor, the aristocrats of Polish labor. They'd not joined in previous labor unrest actions and were among the last to go on strike. But strike they did, with the result being just another stalemate. And the only way out of a stalemate was to change the rules. Which was what the Warsaw Protocol had done, attacking the SB at its core. His limousine glided to a stop and he prepared himself to step from the car. He'd been driven 50 kilometers southwest of Kraków to Wadowice, population 20,000. A fairly unremarkable town, beyond the fact that it was here, on May 18, 1920, that the future St. John Paul II had been born. That event turned an otherwise sleepy municipality into a place of pilgrimage, complete with all of the tacky tourist trappings. Everything of interest revolved around the central square, appropriately named Plac Jana Pawła II. The main attraction was the Wojtyła family house, 1,200 square meters of exhibition space over four floors that charted the great man's life. Family photos, heirlooms, manuscripts, even the gun used in the 1981 attempt on the Pope's life were on display. A renovation of the site had just been completed, and he'd come to see the work and bestow his presidential blessing. The trip had been scheduled yesterday as camouflage on the pretext that since he was nearby, why not drop in for a quick visit? Sonia had called 2 hours ago and said she was on her way back from Slovakia. He'd told her about the detail of BOR agents he'd dispatched, and she told him what had happened. They'd agreed that the agents would scrub the castle clean and dispose of the bodies, removing and destroying all the written materials distributed to the participants, along with the computers on site. Michał Zima would oversee it all, the hope being only they, the Russians, and Eli Reinhardt knew about what had happened. Then there was Cotton Malone. He doubted the Americans would make trouble. If so, they'd have to explain how one of their own made it out unscathed. Unlikely the Chinese, Iranians, or North Koreans would accept any explanation, not to mention the French, a supposed ally. More likely, they'd all think that the United States had the information, and Washington's denials would fall on deaf ears. He checked his watch. 3:20 p.m. He exited the car into sunshine muted by clouds rapidly dominating the afternoon sky. Some of the local politicos were waiting to greet him, and he took a moment to shake hands and chat with them, assuming a patrician but warm smile of welcome. Off to his right, he caught sight of Sonia with a black box in hand. He grabbed the attention of the head of his security detail and motioned. He entered the house, greeted by the curator. They exchanged pleasantries, and he asked if there was a room where he might have a moment. The man offered his office, and he followed him there, where he was left alone. A soft knock came to the door. Then it opened, and Sonia entered. She laid the box on the desk. He took her in his arms, hugging her tightly. "What's that for?" she asked. "Do I need a reason?" She smiled. "No, I suppose not." He was glad she was all right. "I'm told the location has been sanitized. No trace of the carnage remains, save for a few bullet marks in the floor. Everything found there was burned." "Only Jonty and his man Digenti knew the hiding spot for the information," she said. "I made sure of that before I killed him. He was going to use it as a bargaining chip. The Russians definitely wanted Olivier alive." "It's still a risk, with that information out there in the open. We could not allow Olivier to walk away. Yet we allowed Malone to walk away." "Because there was no reason to kill him," she said. "He was drawn into this, not of his own accord. He has no idea where that information is located, so he poses no threat. It was bad enough that all of the others had to die, and Olivier. I'm in the intelligence business, not murder for hire." He caught the sharp tone in her voice. "I understand. You did what you had to do, and I appreciate it." They'd discussed it at length. He'd never asked or ordered her to kill Olivier, but she'd known what to do. She pointed at the box. "I'll return the spear to the castle." "That definitely needs to be done. Let's make sure there are no loose lips there either." A buzz disturbed their privacy. His phone. He checked the display. His chief of staff back in Warsaw. He answered the call, listened, then said, "Do it." Sonia stared at him. "The President of the United States wants to talk to me. Now." Chapter 56. Cotton recalled a story he had heard while growing up in Middle Georgia on his grandfather's onion farm. A local man ran for county sheriff and garnered only 17 votes. The day after the election, he paraded around town with a gun strapped to his waist. Someone asked him why, and he said, "With as few friends as I apparently have, I definitely need one." He felt the same way. He was back in Kraków, surrounded by strangers, walking straight for the American consulate. Sunshine filtered through broken pewter clouds. He had no idea where Stephanie might be, but this seemed like the best place to start. The time was approaching 4 p.m., the shops and eateries busy for late afternoon. He was stopped at the doors by the uniformed Marines. This time they weren't expecting him. He asked if Stephanie Nell was there, and a few moments later he was allowed inside. He found her on the second floor, eyes dull and red-lined with fatigue, and made a full report, including Bunch's death. "Where's the car?" she asked him. "Parked down the street, with six of the most precious relics in the religious world locked inside." He paused. "All yours. I appreciate the gift, but I doubt it's going to buy me any political capital with Fox. He wants missiles here, and he's not going to stop. We don't get everything we want. What is it you're not telling me? Do you have your Magellan Billet laptop?" She nodded. He felt numbed, confused, and bewildered by all that had happened. He needed time to sort things out, to categorize, compartmentalize, make sense of the confusion. "Can I use it?" "Is it about that book?" And she pointed. He'd brought the volume that he'd found at the castle, The City in Salt, the Vialichka Salt Mine. "That's what I want to find out." She handed over her computer and he opened it to a search engine. He typed in the word Bobola and found a reference. On May 16th, 1657, Cossacks surprised a holy Polish Jesuit in the town of Pinsk. Father Andrew Bobola, aged 65, fell to his knees, raised his hands toward heaven, and exclaimed, "Lord, thy will be done." The Cossacks stripped him of his holy habit, tied him to a tree, placed a crown of twigs upon his head, then scourged him, tearing out one eye and burning his body with torches. One of the ruffians then traced, with his poniard, the form of a tonsure on the head of the priest and the figure of a chasuble on his back. Finally, all of the skin was stripped from the body. During this indescribable torture, the priest prayed for his tormentors until they tore out his tongue and crushed his head. Father Andrew Bobola was declared blessed on the 30th of October, 1853. He was made a saint by Pope Pius XI in 1938. At least he now had a Polish connection to the name. One more inquiry. He typed in Bobola and Vialichka Salt Mine and found several hits, one that explained the relationship. The deep Christian faith of the Vialichka miners comes from their Catholic upbringing, as well as the difficult work conditions in the mine. They faced threats from fire, leakages of underground water, and collapse. Holy patrons were supposed to protect them from such dangers. For centuries, the miners cultivated a group of saints whom they worshipped with particular devotion, believing in their powers of intercession. Many were honored with carvings made in the salt, the miners themselves the artisans. One of those carvings was of Father Andrew Bobola. He found an image of the salt sculpture created in 1874, still there in the mine. A little crude and eroded from time and water, it sat alone in a square-shaped niche. A caption indicated that the figure had once been colored white, red, and black, the same paint used for marking the mine's work sites. It had been carved by a miner in his spare time. Located on level 9. He showed Stephanie the chunk of salt crystal. That was on Olivier's person when he died, he told her. And he had that book, all ready to go in an envelope. It all adds up. 9 Bobola. That information is hidden in the mine, where that statue was located, on level 9. He thumbed through the oversized picture volume, finding a schematic of the mine's various levels. Not a lot of detail, but enough to get the idea that it was a huge underground complex. He placed a period on his line of thoughts. "I think that Eli Reinhardt knows this, too. He's going after it. You tell me. Do you know him?" She nodded. "He's an information broker, just like Olivier, but his reputation is not the best. He and Olivier were active competitors, and that information on Tchaikovsky is still worth a lot of money. So yes, if he can, he will go after it. He may already be on the way to that mine, trying to find a way in." They were inside the same office used yesterday, with the door closed. The afternoon sun, still hazy, slanted through the blinds. "We ought to preempt him," he said. He could see she was intrigued by the possibility. "And what do we do if the information is there?" she asked. Let's cross that bridge when we get to it. Neither one of them was comfortable with any of this. Stephanie was defying her employer. He was offending Sonia. But the thought of allowing that information to fall into the hands of Reinhardt seemed repugnant. No telling what would happen then. You think Ivan knows? She asked. He shook his head. He seemed genuinely pissed when Sonia killed Olivier. The phone on the desk rang. Stephanie answered, listened, then pressed a button activating the speakerphone, hanging up the receiver. Mr. Malone, this is Warner Fox. Cotton sat up on the edge of his chair. What happened? The president asked. Exactly what you should have anticipated. The Russians killed everyone. Including Tom. He's not here, is he? You're telling me everyone, including Olivier, is dead. Except you. That's exactly what I'm saying. And before you ask, I'm only here because I got lucky. The Poles were working with the Russians, and both of them were one step ahead of you the entire way. Your lies only infuriated both Warsaw and Moscow. I did what I thought necessary. You have no idea what you're doing, and a lot of people are dead now thanks to you. You won't be paid a dime for your work here, Fox said. He shook his head. You know where you can stick that $150,000. You have no respect for this office, do you? Actually, I have tremendous respect for the presidency. What I lack is any semblance of respect for you. Stephanie, what about the information on Tchaikovsky? Fox asked, ignoring the jab. Any idea where it might be? She glanced his way, and he shrugged, signifying it was her call. None at this time, she lied. I'm about to speak with the president of Poland, Fox said. Who knows you lied to him? Cotton said. Can anything be salvaged? Maybe some pride, if you apologize to Tchaikovsky, Cotton said. Your impertinence knows no bounds, Fox muttered. Did Tom Bunch have a family? A wife and two children. Give them the $150,000. And he meant it. Bunch had been a blind fool, but his wife and children were another matter. Stephanie, please answer my question, Fox said. Nothing I'm aware of can be salvaged. This is over. Then explain to me why the Russians think otherwise. Damn. Fox had practiced the old adage that every good trial lawyer knew. Never ask a question you don't know the answer to, unless you don't care what that answer may be. And he clearly had not. Truth or lie, he had her. The NSA detected a message from a Russian SVR agent named Ivan Fyodorov, currently in Krakow, confirming to the Kremlin that the information may still be in play. Neither of them said a word. I'm going to assume that you both know more than you're willing to share, Fox said. That's fine. Doesn't matter. You're both off this operation. It will be handled by others who are on their way to Krakow now. Stephanie shook her head. Cotton knew what was coming. Stephanie, you're relieved of duty, pending termination. I'll leave it to the Attorney General to decide your fate. Like that decision is in doubt, she said. No, it's not. Unlike you, he understands loyalty. He's an idiot, she said. I won't miss you, Fox said. Nor me, you. And she ended the call. Chapter 57 Tchaikovsky allowed his cell phone to keep ringing. Sonia smiled at his impertinence toward the President of the United States. Finally, he answered. What can I do for you, Mr. President? Tchaikovsky said on speaker. You're not going to win this, Fox declared. I wasn't aware that we were in competition. Tom Bunch is dead, murdered in cold blood. I'm sorry to hear that. What a terrible tragedy. But that concerns me how, Mr. President? You will not get away with this. I'm at a loss. What are you referring to? I'm referring to whatever you had or allowed to be done. Malone reported that everyone was killed and that you and the Russians were working together. Our interests do align relative to this issue. I'll have every dime in foreign aid cut off to Poland in retaliation. He laughed. Really?
All 10 million euros worth. Go ahead. We shall not miss it.
The United States had never been generous with Poland when it came to foreign aid. True, they considered the country of strategic importance and were always willing to provide military assistance, but that always came with some ceding away of pride or possessions. With a constant looming threat from Russia, previous Polish administrations had been willing to make that deal. He was not. I was referring to the $150 million in military sales we allow to Poland, Fox said. He'd been warned about Fox by other European leaders who'd already dealt with him and made their own assessment. Rude, pedantic, arrogant, willfully uninformed, quick to anger, especially when challenged, big on threats, like now.
May I ask what would be the basis for cutting off those military sales?
Your refusal to cooperate with an ally. If our missiles aren't good enough for you, then our military hardware should be treated the same.
That would be unfortunate, he said, but we will just buy those arms elsewhere. I'm sure the Chinese or the French would appreciate the business.
That's not the same as made in America, and we both know it. Our weapons are the finest in the world.
Another assessment he'd been told about Fox was an irrational belief that all things American were best. I'm sure the Chinese and the Europeans would disagree with your statement. No matter. I will not be coerced by you or anyone. There will be no missiles on Polish soil. None at all. You are putting this country at risk, and that will not be allowed. Nor will I suffer the insult of a refusal from a second-rate, barely above a third-world nation. If it weren't for us, all of you would be speaking German.
His gaze met Sonia's, and her eyes signaled for him to keep his temper. Play this out. Calmly.
He nodded, then said, As I recall, Mr. President, it was the Soviets who liberated us. Then your country and England allowed Stalin to steal our nation and subject us to 45 years of brutal oppression.
Ungrateful. That's what you are, Tchaikovsky. Ungrateful. You and all Europeans. We saved your ass. All we ask is a little loyalty. We have a serious situation here. Representatives from several sovereign governments were murdered today, trying to buy information with which to blackmail me, yourself included. Don't interrupt me.
The last I looked, Mr. President, I was the duly elected head of a sovereign government. We are equals. That is the one thing we are not.
Tom Bunch was gunned down. That's not going to go unanswered.
I was there, Sonia said.
Who is that? Fox asked.
The person who killed John de Olivier, she said. The rest were killed by the Russians.
Good luck answering that insult, Mr. President.
Are you prepared to start World War III?
Killing Olivier was stupid, Fox said.
No. Trying to blackmail the president of Poland was stupid. We just countered that.
I have agents on the way there, Fox said. This will be dealt with, decisively.
He'd had enough. And if those agents violate any law of this country, they will be arrested and imprisoned.
I'm sure the Slovaks would love to know what happened within their jurisdiction today. My next call will be to them.
Interesting that Fox did not seem to have a full grasp of the situation, unaware that the site had been sanitized. He could see that Sonia had come to the same conclusion. She mouthed, Malone. He nodded. Made sense. He'd made a report, but Malone would not have known what subsequently happened either.
I would encourage you to do whatever you deem necessary, Tchaikovsky said.
After all, you are the President of the United States, and who am I to argue? I'm just the leader of a second-rate, barely above a third-world nation.
I'm going to have those missiles in Poland one way or another. Either you're going to do it, or your successor. There's something you don't know.
They both waited.
You failed. The Russians say the information on you may still be in play, and they're going to get it. but not if I can help it. He was instantly concerned, but knew better than to let on.
Good luck with that, too, Mr. President.
And he ended the call.
Is that possible? He asked Sonia.
Olivier said repeatedly he was the only one who knew the location, and that made sense. Why would he trust it to anyone else? He said that not even his man, DeGenti, knew the location. But DeGenti is dead.
Did that man talk before he died?
I have no idea.
Could the Russians be bluffing just to keep Fox off guard? They could manufacture documents. They've done it before.
He could see she was thinking, her mind racing. I need to make a call. She found her phone, punched in a number, spoke for a moment, listened, then said goodbye.
Cotton and Stephanie Nell left the American consulate together 20 minutes ago. We watched the building daily, and we caught a break. Cotton used the car I found at the castle with the spear and the other Arma Christi relics inside. After I retrieved the spear, I tagged the car with a tracker. I thought we might want to know where the remaining relics ended up.
Sonia's phone buzzed. She answered, then muted the call.
The car is moving out of town, east toward Vyelichka. I need to head that way.
He nodded. She unmuted the call and told her man to keep her posted. Then she turned for the door to the small office.
Wait, he said. I'm coming with you.
Chapter 58.
Cotton drove, with Stephanie in the seat beside him. He sympathized with her untenable position. Of course, none of it mattered any longer, since she would soon be unemployed. True, he did not know her exact age, but it was definitely past 65. So she could retire, travel, enjoy herself, visit more with her son Mark, who lived in southern France, build on her relationship with Danny Daniels. But he knew none of that was going to happen. Stephanie was an intelligence officer through and through. Her husband had died long ago, and her career had become her life. Was that a good thing? Maybe not. But it was a fact, and she seemed content with the choices she'd made. He knew of countless situations where her cool head and hard decisions had made all the difference, where the United States owed her a debt of gratitude. Hell, she'd even been shot in the line of duty. And what had she received? A pink slip. The good thing, he said, is that Fox's people have no idea about the possibility of a connection to the salt mine. The bad thing is someone's tailing us. I assumed that would happen, Stephanie said, her gaze fixed out the front windshield. Fox will want to know what we're doing.
I'm going to drive past the mine. I'll lose them on the other side of town. Then we'll double back.
He paused. I'm sorry this is happening to you.
I've always wondered how my career would end. Nothing goes forever. And God knows I've had a great run and lingered far longer than I should have. So maybe it's time to walk away. Move on.
Who are you kidding? He caught the grin on her face as she went silent and he checked the rearview mirror. The same car he'd noticed in Krakow remained three back. He assumed it was someone from the embassy. Maybe one of the Marines, responding to an order from the White House. Fox had surely wanted Stephanie and him watched. But in his rookie arrogance, Fox had not even considered that two experienced intelligence officers would anticipate that move and be ready to counter.
I'm kidding myself, she finally said. You and I both know that. I'm not ready to leave.
Her world had always been about secrets. Nothing was as it seemed. Every word, every act, suspect. That was how an intelligence officer lived life, and it was tough to readjust. Which he knew from his own experience. This isn't over, he said. If we find that information, the value of your stock just rose. He entered the small town of Vyelichka. It lay in a valley between two ridges, 10 miles southeast of Krakow. Its old architecture blended perfectly with the greenery of its parks and charming alleys. It had historic churches, a market, and a monastery. But its claim to fame was the salt mine beneath it, which he specifically avoided, easing through the center of town, then out the other side, still headed southeast. Traffic thinned. Their pursuer stayed about 500 yards back. No cars between them now. Enough cat and mouse. On a flat stretch of pavement, he eased off the gas and allowed the other vehicle to come close. It approached the left rear quarter. He swerved into the opposite lane, slowed a bit, and allowed the car to draw parallel. A gun appeared. He and Stephanie slumped down. "That's no Marine," she said. He agreed and played the steering wheel, slamming the right side of his car into the left of the other, momentarily preventing any shooting. Then he pumped the brake and allowed the car to skid to a stop, the other vehicle speeding ahead, where it executed a smooth U-turn and headed back in their direction. He stamped the accelerator and yanked the steering wheel hard left. A quick roar of an engine came before the skid of rubber as the rear wheels caught the pavement. The car spun, the rear end swinging to change places with the front. He straightened out the hood, giving the engine more gas. He reminded himself that the back seat was loaded with precious relics, which were bouncing around unimpeded. "Like a damn roller coaster ride," Stephanie said. "Good to see your skills are still sharp." He grinned. "We're just getting started." The gun from the castle lay on the console between them. "Get ready to fire," he told her. Stephanie grabbed the pistol. They were now headed back toward town down two lanes of asphalt. Their pursuer shot out of his lane and crossed the double line into a hole in incoming traffic, trying to get to them. Horns blared. The car swept back into their lane, now directly behind them. Cotton was doing nearly 120 kilometers an hour. They would run out of highway a few miles ahead when they re-entered Vialichka. But their pursuer seemed without fear. Or brains. The car closed straight on and popped them in the bumper. Cotton's right foot slammed the brake, which caused another collision. But he was ready for it, spinning the wheel left into the other lane and braking again, allowing the other vehicle to draw alongside. Stephanie rolled down her window and fired twice, once into the driver's side window, the other into the front left tire, which burst. Cotton floored the accelerator, knowing what was coming. The other car veered hard left off the road into the trees. "Nice shooting," he said to her. "I still have some talent." That she did. He parked in a paved lot specifically for visitors to the Vialichka salt mine, in a space that provided quick access out. They crossed the street and headed for the Daniwovich shaft, which a placard informed them was the only way down for general visitors. The mine complex, at ground level, stretched for acres, its various buildings incorporated into the town, which had been built centuries ago to accommodate the miners and their families. They'd left the consulate in a hurry, speaking to no one. But Stephanie had made one call before they fled the building, one she hadn't elaborated upon until now. "I spoke with our ambassador to Poland before we left," she said as they walked. "He's one of Danny's holdovers. Fox has not filled the post yet. Needless to say, he's not a fan of our new president. I had him make a call. He knows the right people to get us inside unnoticed." The time was approaching 5 p.m., and there was still a modest crowd waiting to gain entrance. Maybe 100 people. Just past where the line to buy a ticket ended, a short petite blonde stood, dressed in official-looking coveralls. She seemed to be waiting for them and stepped right up, introducing herself as Patricia. She said, "I was told you want access to level 9. "Can we do that, and fast?" Stephanie asked. "I've been instructed to do whatever you want. Let's get you changed and we'll head right down. You're going to need some equipment. That level is not like the tourist areas. It's on the miners' route." He was not looking forward to this. Tight spaces were not his favorite. Stephanie seemed to sense his anxiety and said, "I'm told the tunnels are wide and there's plenty of ventilation. Is that right?" Their guide nodded. "It's not cramped down there at all." But he wasn't comforted. He'd heard that disclaimer before. What concerned him more, though, was the Russians and Eli Reinhardt. One or both could be headed here, too. The guy they'd just encountered was employed by one of them. He glanced around, seeing nothing that caused alarm. But that didn't mean trouble wasn't nearby. Chapter 59. Eli stepped from the car. He'd hired a cab to drive him from Krakow to the salt mine. Not a long trip, though costly at 100 euros. But the driver was an entrepreneur too, just like him, so he couldn't blame the man for predatory pricing. His entire business hinged on taking advantage of others. He stood before the graduation tower, an enormous castle-like structure crafted of larch branches and blackthorn, upon which salt brine flowed 24 hours a day. The microclimate created within the gaudy wooden structure worked like a natural inhalator, the salt air able to penetrate the mucous membrane of the respiratory system, good for lungs, sinuses, intestines, even the brain. Salt baths had existed in the area for hundreds of years, the mine below producing an abundance of concentrated brine that had to go somewhere. So toward the end of the 19th century, the locals started pumping it to ground level and created a spa. He paid the price for an admission ticket and strolled into the tower, heading up a walkway that wound a deep path into the 20-meter-tall wooden structure. Its working principle seemed simple. Take salt suspended in water, pump it to the top, then allow the brine to thicken as it flows down the branches, breaking up as it hits each twig, partially evaporating, saturating the air with a curative saline aerosol. He sucked in a few deep breaths, which felt good. He should take better care of himself, especially now that he was 5 million euros richer. Munoz had called and told him to come here, near the top of the tower, which sat within sight of the salt mine's main entrance. He caught glimpses of the afternoon crowd, many headed to their cars to leave, through breaks in the outer walls. Not many people were partaking of the curative effects today, which was good. He needed a little privacy. He rounded a corner and saw Munoz and Conrad ahead.
"What is this about?" Conrad asked with concern. "And how did you know where I live?"
"My business is information."
"Where is De Genti?"
He knew better than to tell the truth.
"We are handling matters now.
Mr. Olivier made it clear that all of this had to be held confidential. He said nothing about you being a part of that."
"I was here last evening. I am a part of this." He decided to soothe the man's clear anxiety. "I require your assistance. For that, I'm prepared to pay you 100,000 euros. Conrad's face froze in surprise.
"That's far more than De Genti ever paid me.
Unlike Mr. De Genti, I believe that people should be adequately compensated for their services. Is that amount satisfactory?" Conrad nodded. He'd long ago learned that everyone had a price. The trick was finding it, then being able to pay. Luckily, neither was a problem here.
"What do you want me to do?" Conrad asked.
"Take us to the statue of St. Bobola on level 9. He watched as the request was considered. He'd learned of the connection between the saint and the mine from the internet.
"I think I know where that is," Conrad said. "It's inside this small chapel."
"Excellent. How fast can you get us there?"
"Half an hour. Maybe faster." "When do I get paid?"
"When we return from the statue. Of course, we need discreet access, with no attention whatsoever. The more anonymous, the better."
"I can take care of that. De Genti wanted the same thing.
But I'm paying much more than he ever did, so I expect more."
"As do I," a new voice said.
He turned and saw Ivan waddle his way toward them, like a plow horse, bulky, bony, with black, oily eyes like a crow. He felt his head spiral upward toward a different reality, one where he wanted to stay. But he couldn't. He had to maintain control of the situation, though he could feel the confidence draining out of his fingertips.
"Conrad," he said, "could you arrange for that access? Mr. Munoz will come with you.
Art, come back and get me when all is ready." Munoz and Conrad started to leave.
"Add one more to tour," Ivan said.
Conrad stopped. Eli realized there was no choice.
"Do it."
Conrad nodded and headed off with Munoz. Eli faced Ivan.
How did you know?
I've been doing this long time. Reading people is talent I have. And besides, I not trust you ever. So I watch close.
Ivan motioned to his eyes with his fingers.
You find something at castle I saw in your face. Why you think I let Malone go so easy?
Ivan pointed.
You know what I want to know. I want information on Tchaikovsky. I had hoped to sell it to you.
Ivan chuckled.
Sure you did. But I have better deal. I let you live in return for information.
He'd known that was coming.
Why don't you just go down without me and find it yourself? There's no need for me to be involved any longer.
I disagree. You most important. We go down together. Cotton Malone is on his way here.
Great.
I have men trying to stop him. Seems this whole venture is becoming crowded. My thought, too.
He definitely had a problem. Going down into that mine could be a one-way trip. But he doubted this Russian had come alone. So there was nowhere to run. No. Go down. Deal with things below, where the darkness and solitude might give him an edge.
All right, he said. We go together.
A disdainful smile worked at the corner of Ivan's mouth.
You were paid much money. More than enough to cover information, too. That information is worth far more than 5 million euros. Not for you. Call it price of lying.
Again, he had no choice.
Let us conclude our business and be done with each other.
Be grateful, Mr. Broker, I don't kill you.
You don't know where the information is hidden. See how far that got Olivier.
Not much.
Don't push me. I want information, and I want to be done with this.
But he was not buying a single word. Russians lied with uninhibited ease, a talent that came with them from the womb. He had to go down with this devil. That was the easy part. But getting back up in one piece, that was going to take some effort.
Chapter 60.
Tchaikovsky felt a measure of freedom. For the first time in 5 years, he had no BOR security people in tow. No media, no aides, only Sonya. It had taken Mikhail Zhima's direct order to have his bodyguard stand down. Having Sonya with him helped soothe Zhima's concerns. If anything happened, it would be Zhima who'd take the fall. But the head of the BOR had assured him that he was prepared for any consequences. He was re-evaluating his opinion of Zhima. The man seemed a team player, sensitive to the gravity of a delicate situation and its political effects, recognizing that everything quite literally seemed at stake. A call had come a few moments ago to Sonya's phone telling her that the car ferrying Cotton Malone and Stephanie Ngo was now parked in a lot adjacent to the Vialichka salt mine. A strange place for two American intelligence officers to head. They were not tourists. He'd been down in the mine several times over the years for concerts and ceremonies. The whole place cast a surreal air, like being inside a shopping mall 100 meters below Earth. Still, the tourist areas were but a tiny part of the massive complex. He wondered if there was more hidden down there than new salt deposits.
Why are they there? He muttered.
Sonya drove the car she'd been using all day. He sat in the passenger seat, his tie and suit jacket gone, the collar to his white shirt open, his sleeves rolled up.
I don't know, she said. It is peculiar.
It has to relate to the Russians.
What Fox said. The information is still in play, and somehow Malone got ahead of them.
Or maybe just even with them.
She kept speeding down the highway, headed toward the salt mine. He imagined himself no longer president, his second term over, free of all political and personal entanglements, able to do as he pleased. That would be a first. His entire life had been one responsibility after another, working his way up until he achieved the pinnacle of Polish success. He recognized that the presidency was in many ways more ceremonial than practical, but there were areas where he possessed true power. One of those was in approving agreements with foreign governments. This would be so much more difficult if Parliament had the final say. Good luck getting them to agree on anything. Not much had changed in the 3 centuries since the Liberum Veto was finally abolished. True, everything no longer had to be unanimous, but achieving a simple majority vote could prove equally vexing. I freely forbid. Poles took that declaration to heart, both then and now. Thankfully, the decision to place missiles on Polish soil was his alone. There would be a great many within Parliament who would look favorably on an increased American presence, as was evident years ago when the first effort was abandoned. But there were others who would resent any and all foreign interference. He suspected they would be in the majority, though not by much. The missiles would be viewed as a slap to Moscow. There was no other way to view it, and that had never been taken kindly by Poland's neighbor to the east. He doubted anyone in Europe or America would ever go to war to protect an independent Poland. NATO or no NATO, Poland had always been expendable, and would remain so. "This all rests in our hands," he said in barely a whisper. "We can't allow the Russians to get that information." "I won't," Sonia declared. Her phone vibrated and she answered the call, which lasted only a few seconds before she ended it. "They're headed into the mine. We need to delay them." He found his own cell phone and called Zhima, explaining what he wanted. "Delay, but don't stop them. We need another 15 minutes. No surprise that Zhima said he could handle it. "What are we going to do once there?" he asked her, after ending the call. "Try to stay close without them noticing." He glanced down at his left hand and the ring he'd worn for decades, fashioned by a long-dead Warsaw jeweler. Not gold, as that was a rare commodity in Soviet-controlled Poland, and remained so in the years thereafter. Instead, pewter had sufficed in a simple statement of patriotism. Back in the 10th century, Bolesław the Brave had been the first to use the white, single-headed eagle as the symbol of the king. He was also the first to call the area Polona, after a local tribe that had occupied the land for a millennium. The display of the eagle was now mandated by the Polish constitution in precise terms. White, upon a red field. The crown, eagle's beak and talons gold. The wings and legs outstretched, its head angled to the right. He'd worn the ring every day for the past 30 years. A reminder of his life's dedication. But for the first time in a long while, he was afraid. Not since that day in Makotów prison had he felt so helpless. Only after, when he first met Mira Katya and realized that he actually had a choice, had his anxiety waned. Here was the same. There were choices, but none seemed good. Chapter 61. Cotton zipped up the green coveralls that he'd donned over his clothes. He and Stephanie were inside a locker room, part of a building that accommodated one of the shafts used only by the miners. The tourist shaft was in another building, still busy ferrying visitors up and down. Another set of elevators was located farther away, where special groups for a miner's experience made their way below. Their guide had avoided those hot spots and led them to this employees-only area. The gun from the castle was now safely tucked at his waist beneath the coveralls. He assumed bringing weapons into the mine was not allowed, so he'd kept its presence to himself. But after what happened on the road, he was not about to leave it up here. "Not much in the way of fashion," he said to Stephanie, "but functional." She donned her helmet with light. "We look like the Mario brothers." He grinned. "That they did." Stephanie sat on a bench and slipped on the boots their guide had provided. He'd already laced his up, which fit snugly. "Here we are," she said. We have a trunk full of sacred relics out in the parking lot, and below may be some extremely damaging blackmail on the President of Poland. The people I've dealt with for the past few decades, the people I worked with to protect the country, the vast majority of them would have never placed me or themselves in this untenable situation. Yet here I am. You have to play the cards you're dealt, and you know that. That's the problem, Cotton. I don't even have a pair of twos here. If we find those documents, you'll have a royal flush. To do what with? Maybe Senator Danny Daniels can use them to make a move on Fox. I'm sure trying to blackmail the president of a foreign nation qualifies as high crimes and misdemeanors. Perhaps he could encourage the House to impeach the idiot. She shook her head. That only amplifies the problem. Everybody loves to scream impeachment, but that's not a tool to undo elections. The people chose Warner Fox. The fact that he may be incompetent is really not at issue. They've already decided they want him to lead them. You've become quite the fatalist. Just a realist. He had to say, I assume you wouldn't wait here while I go below. She smiled at him. You've always looked after me. I could say the same to you. Back that first day we met, she said, in the Duval County Jail, I wasn't quite sure I'd made the right decision going there. The reports on you were all glowing. But that first impression? You shot a woman who murdered her husband, then tried to kill me. I know. You handled yourself well in that situation, as you did in that first assignment. I knew then I had a winner. She finished tying her boots. For the record, I'm not interested in having Danny fight my battles. You'll have a hard time keeping him out of it. I know, and I love him for it, but this is my problem to solve. Fox has wanted you gone from the start. The only bargaining chip you have may be waiting below. Which isn't saying much, since I think this whole thing stinks. The door to the locker room opened, and their guide returned. Arrangements are all made, Patrizia said. We can head down in a few minutes. I brought a map of Level 9. She laid out a large sheet of heavy paper that detailed a labyrinth of twisting tunnels and chambers. St. Bobola's statue is one of hundreds scattered around the entire mine, Patrizia said. It was carved in the 19th century. I'm told it's not in a good state of repair. Strange that it seems so important. He realized they needed to maintain this woman's cooperation while revealing as little as possible. But there was also an element of danger here, especially if the Russians or Eli Reinhardt decided to show up. He could only hope that he was ahead of them, as he did not want to place this woman in jeopardy. Let's just say that it might be what's near it that's important, he said. That's why we need to have a look. The statue is located here. She pointed to a spot on the map inside a small chamber along a secondary drift on Level 9. Several tunnels led in and out. It's a junction point, Patrizia said. Many of the chapels were placed where tunnels joined. How did Jonty Olivier get those documents down there? Stephanie asked. I assume that's not a spot someone could just wander into. Patrizia nodded. Only the guides can get there. She unzipped a pocket in her coveralls and removed a small plastic fob. This unlocks the elevators for the lower levels. About 50 of the guides carry these on a daily basis. We have to turn them in at the end of each day. He glanced at Stephanie. That meant Olivier had arranged for a way down too, one that included a guide. And if the Russians wanted down, they'd have to do the same. That might work in their favor and provide them enough time. Let's deal with that later, he said to her, knowing she was thinking the same thing. She nodded. You do know, in 1978, this was one of the first places ever given the distinction of being a World Heritage Site. He caught the significance of her humor. I'll try to be careful. And he thought of Sonia. Was she aware of this latest development? The Agencia Viviadu ranked as a first-rate intelligence agency. If Warner Fox knew the Russians were still in the game, the AW would know that too, and Sonya would not be confined by rules or fobs. He needed to stay alert. The plan? In and out. Fast. Clean. No mistakes. Chapter 62. Tchaikovsky walked with Sonya. They'd first found the car Malone had used, parked in a public lot, minus the sacred relics Sonya had said were lying on the rear seat back in Slovakia. He didn't really care about those. Poland's national treasure had been recovered. The rest were somebody else's problem. He was worried, though, about being recognized. No street clothes this time, like the monastery. One good thing was that the vast majority of people around him were tourists who had no idea what the president of Poland looked like. But he'd feel better once they were inside. After locating Malone's vehicle, they drove farther into the royal free mining town of Wieliczka, to Zupny Castle, where Zima had directed them. Named for the Zupnik, the royal administrator of the salt mine who once lived inside, it had stood since the 13th century, but like much of Poland, was destroyed during the war. Surprisingly, it was rebuilt during the time of the communists. The attractive Gothic castle now came with a fortified wall, tower, and outbuildings that housed mining exhibitions, where visitors discovered the history of both Wieliczka and its mine. But they'd not come for the sights or an education. They parked in another public lot and walked up a tree-lined cobbled path to the castle entrance. Waiting for them was a short, stumpy man in a suit who introduced himself as the mine manager. Apparently, Michał Zima had some serious connections and had gone straight to the top, conveying the appropriate instructions about not making a big deal over what was happening. "I appreciate your assistance," he said to the manager. "We need to know the exact whereabouts of two people who were here on site." "That was explained to me by your security people. We have full video surveillance of the entire facility." He was not in the mood for chit-chatting. "Then please, take us to the monitoring station." The central security office sat within the castle walls and looked like something out of the space program, with one wall sheathed in high-definition screens. Each displayed a different slice of both the exterior and interior of the mine. "There are three main ways down," the manager said. "We've been watching them all." The man motioned to one of the attendants. "We found the car when it arrived." On one of the screens, the crisp image of Malone and an older woman came into view as they exited the vehicle they'd just seen, stopping only to remove the relics from the back seat and place them in the trunk. "That's Stefan.